There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Greetings, fellow Earthlings, and welcome to the Ethics and Antics podcast. It is I, Tim the Human, with episode one. Hey, yay! It's been a while coming. I've wanted to do this for a long time, but it's not really manifested itself until now. Thanks to Acast, got in contact with me, and sort of synchronistically, we've pulled it together and brought you the first one. So thanks for tuning in. How to start a podcast? That is the first question in my head. I wanted to do it, but when the opportunity comes, I wasn't really sure. How do you even begin it? I had so many ideas. So to help me along on my journey, as I tried to record this once in my bedroom and it just didn't feel quite right on my own, I brought my good friend, fellow philanthropist, spiritual warrior, is Jamie Lorenz.
Oh, give me a hug.
Start the podcast off with a hug.
Heart to heart, though.
Heart to heart. Went the wrong way.
Flip it.
There you go. We all hug the wrong way around, don't we? I realise that, but you can't... Yeah. You can't...
My philosophy is always flip everything. I think we've learned everything so disconnected that if you flip it the other way, you might find the truth sits there.
Yeah, That's a good way. But naturally, we all go to hug everyone the wrong, not heart to heart.
We go to the left-hand side.
We go to the wrong side. Yeah. And if you try...
Very naturally.
It's naturally that we do that.
But really naturally. I mean, it's almost like a given.
As in, we're naturally disconnected and we push each other that way.
It seems that way.
Is that what you're saying? I have this theory, which is way out there. But I feel like British people are more closed than Americans because we pass on the left and not the right, which puts our hearts further away from each other when we cross by each other.
Such an interesting theory.
But most people would think that's a stupid, what are you on about, Tim? But can you roll with that?
Well, we should put that under the category of observationist. I mean, that's a good observation.
But how often, like when I'm walking in England, I'm so aware that I should pass people on the left-hand side.
Yeah.
And my ego flares up if someone tries to pass me on the right and I'm clearly set my intention to go to the left of them and they've kind of countered that. And I just, like, the angry part of me, like, sort of assumes they're a foreigner or something. And it's like when I'm travelling and I'm abroad and I'm aware that they drive on the right-hand side, I should pass everyone on the right. I have to keep checking myself when I'm walking down the street and almost going to pass into someone. Mm.
Yeah. It's a bit like yoga, though, isn't it? When you breathe, they teach you to breathe out of one nostril because it stimulates a part of the mind, and then the same with the other nostril. I mean, again, I don't know how much science backs this up, but it does seem like, you know, that the left portion of your body relates to the right-hand side of your brain and the right hand. You know, they talk about creators being left-handed and being logical. You want to use the left part of your brain. Yeah. It seems almost the same with where your heart sits, right? Yeah. It sits on the left.
Yeah. So my point is when we're passing on the left-hand side of the other human, it puts our hearts further apart. So energetically, we don't cross as close. If your heart is sort of the centre of your energy, and it's some hypothetical pseudoscience world that I sort of believe I live in, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, sure.
That when we're passing someone on the right, you're passing closer to the heart. So every person you drive by in the street, energetically, you're... If you've got an auric field, if such thing happens to exist, you pass at a closer point.
What I've noticed in London is that there's an amazing connection in terms that if, for example, if you get pulled over by the police and you relate to the policeman in a certain way or you deal with them in a certain way, you can build a connection very, very quickly.
In America,
you have no chance.
The police plays a role of a different... Like, they're not on the same level, are they?
It's mechanical. Yeah, I mean, it's robotic almost.
And as a parkour athlete, I get the same experience. Yeah. When I'm in America, you can't say a word. In England, you can talk back, explain yourself, explain what you're doing, and you can talk to them as a human, see eye to eye.
Well, you can connect. That part, I love Britain. And I mean, London...
And it's the same with the homeless person. In England, you don't feel as distant from the homeless person, whereas in America, the distance between the pedestrian and the homeless seems massive. And in England, you feel more connected to them. So you're right that the top end and bottom end are not as far apart.
But in the UK or in Britain, I find that everyone almost likes to be disconnected. Like there's that you have this connection. It's like the disconnection sits very shallow, and that the essence of our society is, you know, we only communicate when we say sorry for bumping into each other. Mm. Or, you know, it's usually mainly apologies that kind of bring us together.
I mean, we are talking more London than the rest of England. Yeah. As well. I travel out, it's a bit more open, but certainly London is.
London definitely has that.
So is that the blessing and curse of it being so cosmopolitan? It is the, like...
I don't know what it is. I think it's a lot to do with just the general ambience. I mean, I know when I got back from Los Angeles and spending time in Venice, and, you know, all the neighbours say hello to one another, and I got back to my dad's house, and the neighbour was sitting outside on the patio on the front and didn't even look up to say hello. I mean, you know, there's a point where if somebody was coming into the proximity or my near proximity, I would look up and acknowledge them. It's an acknowledgement.
Yeah.
And I think that disconnection sits quite prevalent in London. But at the same time, on the kind of flip side, this is amazing connection that you can actually surpass that, and you get to a lovely place where you can connect with people on a really deep level because they're incredibly logical in London. There's something about this city that just thrives logic. And I miss that when I go abroad sometimes.
I hear what you're saying. I have the same thing when I get the elevator to my apartment. I'll say hello to the person in the lift, and sometimes they won't respond. And then sort of I'll say hello a second time to see if they were really, like, trying to avoid the hello. Hello, just kind of testing.
The elevator's are notoriously awkward anyway.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, we struggle in those.
It's true.
There was something we were talking about recently, which was that if you want to... Because I think there's this default brain that seems to consume us, right? And so when you get into a lift and it's silent, you almost have to become silent because everyone else has become silent. It's like this force that comes upon you. If you fight that voice occasionally, it sets you into a new reality that's unique to your own existence. So I know when someone hugs me, for example, my brain goes, all right, it's time to finish the hug. And so I let go of the hug. But when I don't listen to that voice and I go past maybe 3 seconds over the hug should be on for, I find myself in a very trippy, unusual place that I believe is actually where we should be. We should try to push the default mind into new areas of our reality. And I think we can do that by contesting certain defaults, and elevators being dead silent could be one of those defaults.
But it's true, but even the hug scenario that you talk about that we all go through daily, I think generally people are more and more receptive to hugs nowadays.
Yes,
it's really
because
people are opening up. They become, you know, they're not as scared of a hug now, and those ones that were already hugging back in the day, they're getting longer hugs, you know, and it's becoming more intuitive when to release the hug, and it is getting longer and longer, I guess.
Yeah,
I find it.
I think you're certainly right. There's a lovely TED talk from Dr. Love about oxytocins and how you know, 8 hugs a day makes the depression go away.
Yeah.
I think we're starting to realise that we live in a kind of limbo land. We crave love, but we have this resistance to kind of touch and be tactile with people. And I think we're becoming more tactile, and through that, you know, we'll become truly more happy.
Yeah, and just becoming more open and comfortable in our own skin, that contact with others is not as daunting a task.
Oh, but it feels so daunting sometimes in the beginning. It does feel
daunting. With new people?
It's always that kind of, you know, it's something that I certainly challenge, but I understand the severity when you're in that kind of aggy, depressive place that city life can sometimes bring upon you, that the idea of touch is so like, you know, it's kind of, you almost resist it. But then when you flow into it, you're like, you know, it's soothing almost.
It is.
Yeah.
What about the old handshake? That's why we've moved to hugs. Because handshakes have become too complex. There's too many handshakes.
Yeah.
That if you just hug, if you just do that from the start, you're in and out. Anyway, enough of handshakes and hugs. And when I started this podcast and I was deciding what to do for the first podcast, for the first episode, I was going to tell 3 stories.
Mm.
The first one was going to be winning the World Freerunning Championships. And we actually tried to record that a few times, and it wasn't enjoyable for me. That's a long part of my history. That was 7 years ago now. And it was an important part of getting to where I am now, but it doesn't need to be told anymore. The second story was going to be climbing the pyramids of Egypt. Now, I've told you this story before.
Yeah. And I watched the vlog as well, the YouTube video.
Yeah.
Yeah. I watched the YouTube. I mean, as I said, I try and deal with these emotions, especially jealousy. But I have to tell you that that's one of the stories that you've had that I'm epically jealous of.
Thanks, man.
Yeah,
I think that's a compliment. Is that a compliment?
Well,
I'm jealous of you, dude. Thanks, man.
Well, not of you, but of the action of what you did. I think that's, you know, to climb the Pyramids of Giza.
I'm glad it's over now, and I'm glad I've done it.
Yeah, but I think that's definitely an interesting place to start. So maybe
I was inspired by Graham Hancock. I remember I've been to a talk of his, seen him live, and he talked about climbing it, and that sort of inspired me, and then I got to do it. So I was in Egypt for YouTube have a funding program where they fund certain YouTube channels to go and produce content, and so I pitched, this was in 2013, I pitched seven strands to be funded, and actually got funding for six of them, and one of those was a travel series. And I got to travel around. I went to Sweden. Hong Kong was one of the favourite places I went to. And also Egypt was another one that was on my list I always wanted to visit. So I chose one parkour athlete. That was Ben Jenks. I got my camera guy, Giles, who comes along and films everything. And an Egyptian friend from London, Marwan. And we travelled over to Egypt. When we got there, we were greeted by a Egyptian parkour athlete. And he was going to look after us, sort of our fixer, take us everywhere we wanted to go. And of course, you're in Egypt, in Cairo, at some point you're going to want to go to the pyramids. But we found out that this guy, for the last 2 weeks, every night in the evening, had been going to the pyramids and speaking to the locals and trying to build a relationship with one of the locals that he'd heard can guide you. Supposedly this kid was a grave digger, he sneaks around and breaks into all the tomb robber, that's what he was, the tomb raider, and he was a young guy, but he was sort of had some money from robbing these tombs and things. I'm a 16-year-old kid, I don't remember his name, which is probably a good thing, I wouldn't want to put it out there anyway, but it came out that on the day we ended up going to the pyramids to film around there and get away with what we could, because certainly one thing I learned about Egypt was everyone wants a bribe, so you get told off for doing anything, even if they knew it wasn't bad, just because they wanted a bribe from you. So we were around the pyramids in the daytime, sort of eyeing it up, wrecking it up. Massive structures. It was a great moment to finally be there. You know, as a kid, I always was fascinated in Egypt and liked making papier-mâché mummies and things like that. And we shot a bit around in the day, flipping in front of camels and the old typical shots that you'd get. And then we managed to confirm that we're going to have an opportunity to go and climb the pyramids. So we ended up hanging around in this shop that sold memorabilia, or the rafts and mummy statues and Tutankhamun, and hundreds of shops you'll see in Egypt all selling the exact same thing. It was just another shop like that. We had to wait until 2 a.m. So me and Jenks ended up somehow falling to sleep on this marble floor about midnight, freezing cold, marble floor, had all our packed stuff with us. And we had a camera guy, though the problem was we weren't allowed to film because anything like the red light on our camera would be spotted. They woke us up at 2 a.m. We left the shop, sneaking around the streets. Now, this is, from this moment, from even falling asleep on that marble floor, was you have moments in your life which just don't feel like you're living it, like you're sort of a witness to the action.
You're on default.
You're on default. If I'd let my thought come into it, I probably would have wanted out. But I just thought the overriding idea of this one-off opportunity,
oh, that's so huge,
made the decision for me. So I went along with it. We walked down these streets. You could hear people still in the houses listening to the radio, and people coming by. We saw some people coming by and camels and things, and they led us to this hole in the fence down some back alley, and there was a CCTV on top of above the hole, and we sneaked through and just sort of shadowed the fence along for a few hundred meters. So we were within the perimeters, because the whole of the pyramids perimeter is got a fence the whole way around it, so this was our entrance in. And we had one guide, and his friend was helping us as well. We ended up paying them, I can't remember how many, I think it was around £400-£500, English pound, to guide us through this. And they acted as guys, experts. They would go ahead, and we'd be left in ditches in the sand for maybe 15, 20 minutes at a time. They'd go off and come back and say, okay, this way. Then we'd move forward, sometimes 20, 30 metres, not even that far, and they'd go off ahead again for 15, 20 minutes. They'd split off in different directions, come back, speak to each other in Egyptian, decide which direction, I guess Arabic is the language, right? And then we'd go off again. Now, there was one guy in our group, so there was five of us in total. This fifth guy just sort of tagged along, another free-run kid that we'd met that got along with as well. he was really starting to panic as we got closer and closer. We'd hear guards walking around. At one point, we saw loads of dogs. Like, I think there must have been wild dogs start running and howling and barking. And we got closer and closer to the pyramid. But at one side of the pyramid, and this was recently introduced.
You're on the other side of the gate at this point.
We're on the other side of the fence, and we're slowly working our way. We'll probably start off about a kilometer away from the pyramid, from the fence. So we were working our way in. There's a big light up the side of one of the pyramids, which was only introduced within the last year because of these Russian kids that was on the internet. They had to climb the pyramids at night, and it got leaked and it got really famous. These photos that these Russian kids are taking on top of the pyramids and sort of how they did it. So they put this big light on one side of the pyramid to, I guess, disencourage, what's the word?
Yeah, disencourage.
Yeah, people from doing the same thing. And it was about, we've been sneaking for about an hour and a half, and there was we're in the final ditch, and we see a flashlight go onto the pyramid and start looking along along the nook and crannies of the ridges of the pyramid, scouting. We stayed in our ditch, froze for about 15, 20 minutes, and eventually the Egyptian guys decided to go off again and check out the area. They went off, came back to us, and it was a make or break. One of the guys that was with us was starting to panic, and he was making us all nervous. He just brought nervous energy. Me and Ben had just accepted that we're going to try and do it, whatever. He brought nervous energy to the whole group. And so we ended up having to stay in this ditch while one of the guys tried to take him back to the start of the fence and get rid of him before we start to ascend the pyramid. So me and Ben are there just with this one other guy just hanging tight. We started to try and film on our phones at this point, and the guy panicked and started, like, slammed our phones down, no lights whatsoever. Mm. So it ended up, this was all for story for now. Ends up 15, 20 minutes later, the guide comes back with the panicked kid, because there was a guard blocking the exit that we'd come in on, and he had to come back with us. And we'd been here, it was nearly 2 hours at this point of just slowly traversing and getting close to the pyramid. And there's a final, like, 50 metres, because we're in sort of the ruins of other parts. There's like
what time is this roughly now?
We're about 3:30 in the morning, okay. 3:34 in the morning. And there's the whole crawl that we're going across towards the pyramids is across ruins of smaller pyramids and other remains and a small village or something as you get closer. And so we're at the final bit now where there's a 50 metre stretch to the pyramid, to one side of the pyramid, which has got the light facing up it. And we just made the decision now or never. We all committed to it. All of us charged at the pyramid. We got to the base of the pyramid.
The face with the light on it?
The face with the light on it, yeah. Because we couldn't, I mean, it would take forever to try and sneak around to the backside. Yeah, so the side we'd come in on was in the corner. So it was lighting up two sides of the pyramid, basically.
Okay, as you're saying.
So we came on to the right-hand side of where the light was, and we got to the pyramid, and it was such a surreal moment. Even though we'd been there in the day and we touched the same bottom bricks, to be there at night in this moment, it's funny how...
Magical.
Yeah, it was magical, but we heard the dogs start to bark as we started running, and we just started charging up the pyramid. Me and Jenks, you know, the bricks are about from belly button height to shoulder height, each one, and from our parkour background, we're quite quick. And I guess efficient technique really helps you in scaling something like that. It's like giant steps. And we scaled, and actually remember hearing all the dogs bark, and we were just kept looking around. Some of the guides were a lot slower than us, but obviously they didn't need to guide us at this point. The only way was up to the top. And we went up and up and up and up, got to the top, kept checking around. No guards with flashlights. We were mate. Like, we genuinely, like, almost accepted that this is it now or never. And the guard, it's not like the guards were just going to be friendly and say, come on now, guys. They had AK-47s.
So you had put climbing the pyramids before getting caught. I mean, you resigned to the fact that you...
I'd come that far, and sure. I'd been gone for that long.
I mean, that's commitment, that night. Right?
It was commitment. But and they had AKs. And now, I don't think for a second they would ever shoot us, but I just wouldn't like to even be caught by one of them. And the locals, one of them didn't speak English and one did. He translated for the other one. He was saying how if they caught us, I mean... we'd probably be all right, but they'd be absolutely, you know, they'd get beaten up and everything. There'd be local rat kids kind of thing. They'd be treated so badly. Anyway, me and Jenks made it to the top first. And I actually remember it took about 11 minutes.
You said that. Is, I mean, it just like, it totally shocks me. I mean, I've not been to the pyramids, but
It makes them seem smaller than the idea of
it. It definitely does. Yeah, it definitely has that feel.
Yeah, I wonder how many. They're probably only 200 metres high.
But I mean, that sounds like almost like another world record you've broken there, 11 minutes to climb the pyramids.
Well, the kid that guided us, his. Probably a relative of his was supposedly the record holder.
Do we know the time?
I think it was around then, or maybe it was up and down time. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But anyway, the top of the pyramid.
These are big bricks, right? It's big bricks.
Really thick bricks, yeah. Okay. And the whole, you could bring conspiracy into it, like built by aliens and all that. Maybe we'll talk about that another time. I don't know. I don't know how humans build it, but obviously people have incredible ideas and technology. Regardless of,
but how was your cardio getting up there? I mean, how did you find
it? It was all right, and it wasn't like if I wanted to just stream straight up, it would have gone faster. It was sort of stop start because I didn't want to leave people that far behind. Because
you
actually started to go into clouds, you know. I think not because it was insanely high like a mountain, but it was just sort of the nighttime desert mist kind of rolls in. So we didn't want to lose anyone, but at the same time, when we did get to the top, we were protected from anyone at the bottom seeing us. Now. One thing people and I find interesting, and I would have asked someone if they climbed the pyramids, is what's the size of the top of the pyramid? And I'd say it's about 5 meters squared, maybe a bit bigger, maybe 7 or 10 meters squared. So there's a big platform on top you can hang out on, and then there's a big wooden structure, I think for lightning or something, with a metal thing going up the middle. And I climbed to the top of that one as well. I wanted to get to the top.
And at the top of this, there's a lot of engravings and signatures from other people that have climbed.
There's loads, yeah. So as I said before, that it was illegal to climb the pyramids after the 80s. So people were climbing it up until the 80s anyway. So,
right.
I mean, people certainly have done it in the past. I'm not the only person in the world that's done this. But, and there's loads of engravings. But just the way we went about it and the time period that we did it in, when a lot less people are doing it per year than you'd think. We were in the cloud, we started to take photos and we tried to film, although it was really dark. We could faintly see one of the other pyramids in the background, and I'll find that photo and I'll put it on. If you're listening on Acast on the website, there'll be a photo here. But the real defining moment, and why this is one of the highlights of my life, was when it got to about 5 a.m. So we'd been traveling for about 3 hours, finally got to the top of the pyramid. You hear the call for prayer. You forget you're in a... Muslim country, and they pray 5 times a day. And at one of the times, at around 5:15 in the morning, the whole city rang out. It was 360 degrees of the mosques ringing out, and the people, the guides were all religious, and we just joined in. They all started to pray, kneel down facing Mecca, and we just joined in.
And sunrising must have been happening as well at this point.
It was just starting to come up at this point. Wow. So you had sunrise. You could hear every mosque in the city ringing out, and we just joined in the prayer. And it was, I think, for all of us, it was
defining.
A real defining moment.
Wow!
And then I'll never forget as we finished the prayer and all that, and the sun had started to rise, and we started to see clearly now. We started to descend down into the desert again. And we just didn't feel like it was a problem. We thought like, oh, if we get caught now, it's whatever. Like the sun, it was light enough at that point, and we just like danced down it. The guys were really worried about the way me and Ben went down, but with our parkour, because we just scooted the whole way down, just foot in hand. But it was light, and we just felt, we were like running and giggling and like hugging each other and high-fiving. And we thought, if we get caught now, it doesn't matter because the sun's up. It's funny how things feel so... I can't think of a better word than naughty. Things feel so naughty
at nighttime,
but in the daytime, you just get slapped wrist. Like, oh, what are you doing? You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally.
Like, we just felt like some kids messing around. And then we've managed to get back to the hole in the fence, got out, starving, hungry, and there was a gang of people hanging outside.
And there were no guards saw you come down the pyramids?
No guards saw us leave.
Wow.
It was... such an incredible... Yeah, we got out. They must have been sleeping. I don't know. We weren't quiet. We weren't...
Like
secretive
a,
on the
a
way
promotion
out.
Promotion to go and climb the pyramids.
But yeah, I remember going to eat pitta, going to find the stands that had just made fresh pitta in the morning, and all the families were going to get theirs for the day.
Mm.
And we got some pitta and bought some tomato crisps, and just filled the pitta with
so
tomato
high.
Crisps.
it was an
unbelievable moment, and certainly one of the heights of my life. But yeah, as we started this conversation, you'd seen the video.
Yeah.
And my manager, because they couldn't find my contact, got a phone call from that. We documented. And when I say documented this, we didn't really film anything other than on the top, but I told the story of it in the video that you saw. Mm. My manager got a phone call from the Home Office who asked us to take the video down because they said if the Egyptian government saw it, you know, we could be on their radar. I don't know if I could go back to Egypt right now, that I might, my name might flag up when my passport scans in. And they could find the house we stayed at before we went to the pyramid, and they could find everyone in the video, you know, really easily if they really wanted to. And we put their lives in danger by putting the video up. So we had to take that down, and all I'm left with is the stories and my memories. And
Which is easily enough.
More than enough. This is the old school way of living.
And what a great story.
Yeah, and one photo.
And how long do you reckon, I mean, just riding that high, I mean, you must have been high for 3 or 4 days after that. I mean, you must have been really clear-headed.
It was a lovely trip, you know. Mm. And what else I liked in Egypt was they have the stands in the street that just sell sweet corn and sweet potatoes, and I could live off that. Like, I wish, instead of the popcorn and the hot dog stands we have in the streets here, imagine if they did have just sweet potato, not just salt, newspaper, sweet potato and salt, no butter, nothing. I could just live off that. And that was another, you know, when you're riding that high and then you're just eating clean food like that.
Yeah.
And it was a wonderful trip.
Yeah, well, a wonderful story. Mm. Yeah, as I say, I mean, you know, just when we spoke about it in Venice, the grandeur of it, the size of it, you know, just, I think you missed one point, though, which is that when you got to the top, you know, in kind of Tim Shee fashion, you did a handstand at the very top.
I did, and a backflip.
And a backflip.
And I beat Jenks to it. Okay. So I wanted to race him. Yeah. I didn't say I was
racing
him.
You can't leave that out of the story. I mean, it's you know.
Yeah, of course. Did the old handstand and a backflip on the top of the Great Pyramids of Giza.
Yeah.
That's a moment.
No, it's just too epic.
I did always wonder, did a local Egyptian thousands and thousands of years ago ever do that? Like, did somewhere, I feel like they might.
That's a really good point, actually, because you've got all the signatures. So there's obviously other people that have climbed.
There's probably gymnasts.
How many of them have done a backflip or a handstand?
I reckon at least 10. I've done it before me. At least 10.
What an epic story. I mean, really, something to hold on to for the rest of your life.
Thanks, man. No, it was certainly an experience. And as I said in it, I was on autopilot. I just agreed to do it and then didn't let any doubt creep in, and it worked out.
And that's it, the doubt. I mean, how many people, you know, I mean, I know when I was on a friend's boat and I dived off the top, and I'd done it 10 times, maybe 11 times, and suddenly there were new people watching, and their fear of me doing it resonated, and I suddenly became fearful of the dive, and I suddenly froze up. And amazing that you had someone on the journey with you that was giving off that frequency, and you managed to surpass that and keep doing it and keep pushing through. You know, most people at that point would have given in.
It was certainly an edgy moments in it. But yeah, me and Jenks, Ben, just both agreed to it, and both of us just never gave each other doubt. And together, you know, when you're with a friend that has the same faith as you, that's so much more powerful than just you on your own, and you don't let that overpower you. But that is interesting how you say how you were doing jumping off a boat fine every time, and then as soon as how does the witness change the scenario?
Yeah,
and I guess it's how, because it can change it both ways. You know, you can show off, and the ego creeps in, and then an accident happens because of the witness. Would you have done it without them watching or not? And I learned the same through parkour. Is when I'm doing a jump, am I doing it just for the camera? Am I doing it because someone's watching, or am I doing it for the challenge and overcoming? A new experience.
And I think, obviously, in what you do, you have to be constantly mindful of that, because if you're doing it for the wrong reason...
I feel you're not protected. I genuinely feel like there's a protection in purity. So when I was climbing the pyramids, I wasn't doing it to show off. I wasn't doing it for the documentation or anything. I was doing it because I wanted to experience that.
Yeah, of course.
You know, and if I feel... And I felt a certain, I don't know, angel over me or something in that purity, and I think we all have that. And as soon as you're doing something for... a less pure purpose of impressing women
or
feeding ego, then you lose that guardian on you, and that's when accidents happen. And I don't really believe in accidents.
I truly believe that.
Yeah.
I mean, especially with what you do with parkour. I mean, that's, you know, you must feel that. I mean, there's a feeling in that.
There's a genuine feeling, and it's also an understanding when you're looking at, say, a big roof gap in your head, or jumping to a rail or something like that. There's a doubt will always creep in, and is that doubt like your brain, like a fear that's not, because initially when you look at a jump, you have a split second reaction of I can do it or I can't.
Yeah.
And then as you stand there and look at it for longer and longer, it changes, you know, and this doubt creeps in. And sometimes that might be your brain saying, don't do it, you'll hurt yourself, but it's not based on anything actual. It's just starting to create stories and piecing together YouTube videos you've seen in the past of someone failing. Or is it your gut, actually, and that's your real instinct?
Yeah.
You know, and in the beginning, when you first looked at it, that might have jumped. And it's trying to differentiate between the two. And we each have practices. You know, a musician making a song might make a song and they have a feeling about whether it's good or not, or whether it's, you know, and we each have a practice of getting that out there. And for me, parkour is a way for me to understand whether it's my intuition or my ego telling me to do it or not to do it.
Well, it's interesting you said, because the more you look at it, which inevitably means the more you think about it.
Yeah, you think, exactly.
It leads you into a negative path. You know, we've been, you know, I know we've had discussions in the past about it, about, you know, what is the mind and what's the purpose of the tool of the thinking mind. But just being in the moment and being present and not thinking, I think, is the answer. Because the second we think, you're right, you build up these stories. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, your intuition gets clouded by the imagination of, you know, the imagination of the past or the future or whatever it is that you bring into your existence.
Yeah.
And so being present and being in the now, fundamentally, it's always the answer.
Well, it's weird because that entails living on instinct, right?
Yeah.
Which is sort of part of the spiritual journey, is surpassing the animalistic body and mindset and transcending that, but at the same time it's going towards that and becoming aligned with your instinct again. Like, as children,
yes,
if, and you know the same, when you interact with a child, if you don't really know the kid but it's a cute kid and you're going up to go, oh yes, and you want to play with, the kid's going to run away from you because you're just being weird to the kid, right? Kids act on instinct.
Yeah.
If you're too energetically trying to take from that kid straight away, and the same with dogs, whereas if you in the room with the kid and you're calm and let the kid naturally become interested and come over to you, and then you can start messing around, doing headstands, whatever you want to play around with. Kids live on instinct, and it's good to live with that mindset. When I watch a child, that sounds so weird, doesn't it? Super cute. In a playground, though. Yeah, I was
deep in that. I didn't even spot that one.
I just got to put it out there. But when I watch kids climb, and it fascinates me because I feel like we can learn so much about proper technique from children, because they do it. They never set themselves up to fall. I've had, throughout my parkour career, like, and jumping around, I've had so many parents tell me, generally it's all good, but a lot of times I get parents say, I don't want my kids to see you doing that and copy it. Mm. But when you watch kids, they don't just see you do it. They've come up to me and said, how do you do a backflip? And then they've gone to, like they wanted to do it, but they've always pulled out before they've gone for it. They're not stupid. They're really in control of the body. They know their limits. So when you watch children climb on obstacles, it's very much instinctual. It's one step at a time.
Yeah.
That, you know, they're letting each moment to moment. They're not suddenly, like, as an adult, when you see me stood on top of a building, you go, oh my God. And you put yourself in my body, and you go, if I was there, I would fall, I would hurt myself and that. But you don't understand the practices I've got on, and the process that I even did to get in up there. It was one step at a time the whole way.
Mm.
Whereas, and a child climbing a climbing frame or something, it's one step, they'll grab the railing, they'll put their foot up, they'll grab their other bit, they'll bring their hips in, and it's very much calculated, but it's instinctual calculation. They're not thinking of how to climb the thing, they're just feeling through each step of the way.
Yeah.
And I think as adults, we lose the idea that you can do things one step at a time, and we just look at the end product, and we're afraid of the end product because there's a journey along the way going on that we don't know the experience.
Well, I actually had that. I had that with you. I remember on Regent Street when we were on the top of the buildings, and you did the one-handed handstand. And I remember, you know, I've done stuff with you, and I've witnessed stuff before, but I hadn't witnessed something of that severity. And I remember, I felt that, and as I felt the fear coming in, I had to immediately suppress it, because I knew that if I didn't suppress it, that kind of wavelength channels out and it can cause more nuisance than you want it to. But it's a struggle, that, you know, it is a struggle when you see people doing stuff that's so out of your domain. You know, there's Alex, is it Alex Arnold?
The free climber.
I mean, watching some of his videos, I feel the same.
Yeah, I feel like, what if one hand slips?
I know, but it's just, but you get it. Like,
but he's doing it one step at a time. Oh, he's trusting every step.
He's a genius. He's absolutely, he knows exactly what he's doing.
He's very present.
Yeah, but that's a training in ourselves that we need to do. And that's a lesson for ourselves on that. Mm-hmm. And it's something we all need to work on, because it gets us, you know.
But
you
get it through whatever is your creative outlet.
Mm.
So whatever you do for creativity, you could play the guitar, you could do magic as you like to do, you could do martial arts, whatever, that could be, you know, your channel of an understanding of how to be in the flow of it, and be present. And you even look at someone like Alex and you listen to him speak in interviews, and he's had a lifetime of being very much in the moment for a lot of his lifetime. How many of us are in the moment for a lot of our day? We're often thinking about what we're going to eat or what after work or whatever. Because he's lived a lifestyle, he has a certain energy around life and, you know, when he talks, that is of someone that's still a child.
I think, you know, in terms of this journey, and I'm really grateful, you know, for our friendship. And I think, you know, together we kind of bounce off each other in kind of amazing ways. But you certainly pushed me in places that I wouldn't have done had you not been there. And I think Venice Beach was certainly one of them, where we're walking down the beach and there's a freezing cold ocean. And we all know it's freezing cold. Yeah. And you've gone, let's jump in the ocean.
By the way, I don't want to jump in the ocean.
Yeah, no,
At the moment. But I know that once it's done, how good that feels. And that's one thing I've learned about life is contrast is key, man.
Yeah.
Contrast, that cold ocean makes the warm evening feels so much warmer and nicer and more comforting than if you just go from the sweaty, salty beach into the evening. But if you swim in the ocean, go shower, put on some fresh clothes, go for dinner that evening, you feel like you've accomplished something. And maybe the ocean is even, you know, there's something, some earthing in that. There's some connection with nature beyond just accomplishing something. But it really, like, it just satisfies the soul, you know.
But it's amazing that default mind that says no, you know, that says, I can do it tomorrow, or today's not the right
day. It's an adult mind, isn't it?
It's the adult mind,
because a kid would go in 100 out of 100, would go in that water.
Yeah.
Yeah, because they're thinking, because the kid wouldn't think, oh, but then I have to shower afterwards, then I have to clean, then I have to change my coat.
Especially if the kid had someone that he respected or she respected, pulling, saying, come on, absent every time.
Yeah.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Yeah. I mean, that was, you know, that's definitely a big one for me, because I certainly give into that brain a lot. You know, the mind of tomorrow, which never exists. You know, I spend my life kind of giving into that. But it's something that, you know, you challenge it daily.
Yeah.
And you've been a really good kind of push for that.
Yeah, there was another moment when we were sat on this exact sofa as we're sat right here. It was about 12, I think it was midnight.
Yeah, it was.
And I think I'd recently, a few days before, I'd found a new crane to climb in London, and I'd climbed it, and I was telling you about it, and you seemed interested, and I said, okay, let's go.
Well, no, I wasn't interested.
You weren't interested?
No. Okay. Well, I was, but when you first mentioned it, the default mind went, no, we'll do it another day. And then there was this little silent voice that went, you have always wanted to do this. You're sitting with the parkour world champion. He's offering you to take up a crane. What are you saying no to? And I think at that point, that was when it kind of went, let's do this. And then we had that kind of like, it was like a back and forth about, should we get the Boris bikes down there or shall we get a taxi? I was like, and my laziness again was like, let's get a cab. And inevitably, the Boris biking was some of the highlights.
Part of the journey. The contrast. So the Boris biking to get there, the workout, the tiredness, the fatigue. You get to the crane.
Yeah.
You know, you climb it.
I got to tell you that for me, that was one of the most epic experiences of my life. Because it pulled me out of, you know, for you it's probably one of the kind of normal day-to-day activities you guys get up to, but for me this was brand new. This was an experience.
It was like 35 story crane. It was is on the south side of the river, right near Waterloo, near the Oxo building. That's where it was, wasn't it? We parked our bikes by the IMAX, and walked down the road. Did we hop a few fences to get in?
We left everything, leave no trace. We put everything back as it was.
you hung from a bar about 20 stories off the ground.
Well, again, it was the, you know, because I saw you do it. So, you know, we'd climbed up to a certain part of the building. This wasn't on the crane, this was on the building. And this was about, what, six stories high now, probably?
Six, seven, probably higher. 12 or more.
And there was a little bit of scaffolding, and you had hung from the scaffolding. And I remember thinking to myself, well, you know, I know that if this scaffolding was only a 3 foot high, yeah, I would hang from it no problems.
Yeah.
So the idea of this fall, this drop, this is an illusion. It's an illusion of a reality. I know I can hang from this. Yeah. So there's a point where you kind of over, as we've always said, like fear sits so shallow that once you go beyond that, you suddenly realize this is easy. You know, there's no fear. And so, yeah, you
breaking the matrix.
Breaking the matrix, exactly. But you definitely edged me into that point. And I came off that bit of scaffold. I felt so fresh. I felt so alive. I felt like a child again.
Because how many voices in your head of parents and relatives and people that would have been so terrified, but you knew it was okay.
Yeah.
No one else, you. And you listened to that voice.
And also, I want to live on this planet more than anybody else wants me to live on this planet. Yeah. And so I'm more careful than anybody else can be.
That's a word, that's a phrase I really want to remove from the English language. Mm. Be careful.
Yeah.
If someone says be careful, like, I'm not trying to be... I care about my life. Like, yeah. I'm not trying to be... And no one's reckless. Ever said be careful to someone and they've took that in and gone, oh, wait a second, I better take care.
Yeah.
There's nothing they weren't already doing that they were. Yeah. Or, you know, pay attention. That's a great thing to say to someone.
Of course.
Hey, Jamie, you know when you're going to hang from... Just pay attention to what you're doing. Mm. Make sure your fingers are... You know, pay attention. Be careful, Jamie.
Yeah.
What does that achieve? Well, it does nothing.
It actually induces fear.
It induces fear. It shows that someone else is scared. And they're saying it out of care and love, but it doesn't help a thing.
No.
And it bothers me.
Well, actually, they're not saying it out of care and love. They're saying, I believe, to relieve something from themselves.
Yeah.
So that it gets the weight, because they've got something manifesting in their mind that they need to release. And once they release it, they feel guilt-free. There's definitely a psychological element to that.
Yeah.
But I mean, anyway, so, you know, we were at this building site and we climbed the crane. And the bit for me, which just goes back to, you know, our kind of friendship and where we kind of push each other, but this is more you pushing me, was that we had got to the top of the crane, and we had a little bit left to go to the very top, to where the little platform sits. And so I was down by the bit where the controller was, and there's this like a little bit that leads to the top where you can stand on. And Tim, you had climbed to the top. And I climbed to the top, but I climbed, and I didn't want to stand on the top. I wanted to hold onto the ladder because I knew getting down would be easy.
Mm.
And I remember the wind was just like, whoa, it was almost swearing at me to get off.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, get down. Yeah. And at that point, I did give into fear, and I went down. And I remember you said, look, come up here, stand up here. I was like, no, I'm okay. And you're like, I promise you, you'll regret it if you don't. And I remember those words ringing, and then the wind just kind of went silent, and I climbed up, and I stood up there.
Mm.
And we took a selfie over the London Eye.
With the big red light.
Yeah.
There's a big red light on this.
Yeah, and it was just the most refreshing experience I've ever had. It was so out the box and out the norm of reality. And I rode that high for 3 days, which is why I asked earlier about the pyramids, is because I really did genuinely feel like I was high on life for 3 days just from doing one adventure like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot to learn from that.
Do you know? One thing a day that scares you. Or do something that really scares you and it lasts for 3 days.
Yeah. yeah, the really scary ones are a bit heavy.
Yeah, and then climbing back down, I remember being in the cockpit at 30-odd stories up.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, time to go now. And you turn around and your bum hit the controls and shifted...
The entire crane,
like... An inch, but I streamed down the ladders of that crane.
Well, I mean,
so
for
fast.
you didn't know what had happened. I knew what had happened.
Course, yeah, but yeah. I still didn't want the awareness of someone else. If there's still security on the site, and if they became aware of that,
yeah,
I just didn't fancy getting caught, and to this day, still haven't been caught for anything like that. But we got out, we got back, and you had a good 3 days.
And you know, it's important to align yourself with people that truly push you, not just people that flow with you in comfort zones of sitting in the same plateau that you sat in for years and years. And because the real luxuries and the real happiness comes on the other side of the unknown.
It does. I think have one friend that pushes you, maybe a few more. Not you don't want every friend to push you. You'd be a bit of a terrified wreck. But you know, they say you are the culmination of your five friends. So just make sure that there's one dude around you, or dudette, female, that's just pushing you from occasion. When you don't have to see them every day, but someone you see once a month or so, and when you do, you know there's a challenge coming, and it's going to help you grow into life.
Because it's so rewarding.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really is.
I think that's a good point to end this first episode. I hope you guys enjoyed it. Come back for more episodes. We're going to carry on talking about all this stuff. Spirituality, what was our topic? Ethics and antics, man. We'll go into it all, you know. That sort of, I think that episode sort of sums up everything, right? Because we talked a bit about spirituality and a bit about antics of exploring the world. And I just want to say on that climbing the pyramid, climbing the crane, is that unethical? Can you guys tweet me or something? Ask me, is that ethical or is it unethical? It's illegal. If you get caught, you could get in trouble. But as the way I see it, a pigeon could fly and sit on top of the pyramid. A squirrel could climb a crane and nothing would happen to them. Why should I have any less right to the freedom? If I'm in control and trust myself and leave no trace, why is that any less ethical than animal being able to do it? It's almost reverse speciesism, that as a human I'm not allowed to do something an animal could do. And on that note, guys, thanks for tuning in. See you next time. Peace.
Out.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.